Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Even now, after all the words and film and fury, Americans still tend to have a Gone with the Wind version of slavery running through their minds. Mint juleps and happy mammies, bad, yes, but a manageable chapter at one margin of American history. Celebrated historian David Brian Davis says no, slavery was far more central to the whole American story than that. In fact, he says, it was the cornerstone of the entire New World Project, from Massachusetts and Connecticut to the Carolinas to the Caribbean and Brazil. Slavery, he says, was the economic bulwark of the Americas, and visible bondage was the foil against which many Americans defined their personal freedom. Up next on Point, the true depth of slavery, with historian David Brian Davis. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is David Brian Davis, Professor Emeritus of History at Yale and former director of the university's Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He's one of the country's most honored historians, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the Bancroft Prize, and much more. His new book, which the New York Times calls a tour de force of synthetic scholarship, is Inhuman Bondage, The Rise and Fall of Slavery in the New World. David Brian Davis, thanks very much for being with us.
Wow, it's a great honor indeed.
It's wonderful to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Davis.
Hello.
Professor Davis, there's so much in here. It's so rich and deep. I can't wait to dive in. Right at the outset, you've got this number which struck me between the eyes. In 1770, on the eve of the American Revolution, African-American slavery legal all over the New World, and you remind us, or in my case, tell me for the first time, that for many decades in 1770, there had been five times as many Africans crossing the Atlantic for every European immigrant to the Americas. I wonder if you'd just begin with us, if you'd be good enough, by kind of giving us some comparison of the picture you think most Americans still hold in their minds of slavery and the actual fact and scope of slavery.
Well, I suppose the average American would certainly know that slaves were transported from Africa to America, but would think of this as a rather small trickle compared to the vast migration of Europeans to the New World. And in some ways, it's easy to be deceived because slavery in the United States had a very positive growth rate. So even as early as the 1720s in the Chesapeake, slaves began reproducing very rapidly, and the slave population grew to 4 million or so on the eve of the Civil War. But only 5 to 6% of the slaves transported across the Atlantic actually came to the New World. The greatest numbers went to Brazil and the Caribbean,
or actually to the United States or the colonies in that case. I mean, you remind us that in the Caribbean, in Brazil, the death rate of slaves was so high that it was always replenished, but with new slaves. Whereas in what would become the United States, as you say, the population took off and grew on its own.
That's right. There is a striking contrast. There's a good bit of debate over the causes of this. Certainly, it was far more lethal to be involved with sugar production and being in super hot sugar mills and all. But it was not only the death rate in the Caribbean and Brazil, but also a lower reproduction rate. And Therefore, they were dependent for most of the history of slavery on importing more and more slaves from Africa.
And the scale of... excuse me.
I was just going to say, I do stress that even though the U.S., quote, only imported 5 to 6% of the total number, that number, as I say, grew and grew, and it by no means meant we were less dependent on slavery or... And we were, as I argue, very dependent on trade with the West Indies. And so there are all sorts of interconnections here.
And the scale and centrality of slavery in that early American economy for decades and decades, centuries.
That's right. Even, for example, in the colonial period before the American Revolution, the northeastern colonies, the ones we're in at the moment, were very much dependent on exporting a variety of goods to the West Indies. That was the great market for a good bit of the produce from New England and the Northeast.
David Brian Davis, I wonder if you'd read something from page 102 in the book here that gives a sense of the depth and profundity of slavery's place in the Americas, in the American story, from the vastness of its fact to the astounding sort of within 100 years, this thing that had been going on for thousands of years was finished. Could you read a bit there for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Racial slavery became an intrinsic and indispensable part of New World settlement, not an accident or an unfortunate shortcoming on the margins of the American experience. From the very beginnings, America was part black and indebted to the appalling sacrifices of millions of individual blacks who cleared the forests and tilled the soil. Yet even the ardent opponents of slaveholding could seldom, if ever, acknowledge this basic fact. To balance the soaring aspirations released by the American Revolution and by evangelical religion, slavery became the dark underside of the American dream, the great exception to our pretensions of perfection, the single barrier blocking our way to the millennium, the single manifestation of national sin. The tragic result of this formulation was to identify the so-called Negro, and the historically negative connotations of that word are crucial for an understanding of my point. As the great American problem, the road would be clear, everything would be perfect if it were not for his or her presence.
Historian David Brian Davis reading from his big, new, groundbreaking history of slavery in the Americas, Inhuman Bondage. Jack Beatty, Professor Davis writes, black slavery was basic and integral to the entire phenomenon we call America.
Yes, and as he points out, which astonished me was that if you factor the size of the if you allow for the different sizes of the economy, the values of slaves in 1860 comes in today's money to about $9 trillion, where our whole economy is only 12. I mean, the dimensions of this are just astonishing. I just want to salute Professor Davis. This is an example of history as knowledge and history as narrative, both at maximum strength. And I think that anyone who reads this is really coming in contact with a whole generation of scholarship. You know, one of the valuable points you bring out here, Professor, is the non-economic satisfactions of slavery. You know, it's often treated as all about work and money and capitalism. But there was another side to it, the side of superiority, the side of domination, the side of sadism. And, you know, Mungo Park, the explorer, gives one detail that really brings that out. He's talking about coming out of the Congo with slaves in the 18th century, a body of them, and a man is bitten, and one of the slaves is bitten by bees and has an allergic reaction and just can't move. He's immobilized, and he pleads with the slavers, please slit my throat, kill me. Instead, they tie him to a tree and leave him for the wild beasts. In other words, the sadism was absolutely essential to this thing.
Professor Davis, you describe it as the making into beasts of people.
Yes, let me just briefly qualify one point that Jack makes on the $7 trillion. the value of slaves on at the beginning of the Civil War was absolutely tremendous, and it would it would come to many billions in today's dollars. I did want to cast a somewhat different view on it by looking at the gross national product. And so I was saying that in today's terms, since slaves in 1860 came to about 80%, their value came to about 80% of the value of the gross domestic product in 1860, that would come out as $7 trillion in as 80% of today's gross
as an equivalent portion of today's gross national
product. Today's national, but of course the gross national products are very, very different today, and this can be misleading. I think one needs to add the actual market value of the slaves in 1860, which I do in the book.
Professor Davis, I wish you'd give us a quick short course here in the very long history of slavery and the way it changed when it came across the Atlantic.
Well, slavery goes back really to almost the beginnings of human history, at least when humans began to settle down a bit and become agricultural. You find slave labor in the ancient Mideast and virtually every society in the world. I've even argued that I think it was based on the domestication of animals, so that captives in wars, for example, would be they would try to domesticate them so they would be as hardworking and easy to control as domestic animals.
And using almost the same techniques.
Using very much some techniques. Now, while there was slavery virtually everywhere, only in ancient Greece and Rome do you have what are called slave societies, where the economies were really dependent on large numbers of slaves, dependent on slaves working in all aspects of the economy. And it's significant that the first free societies and democratic ones, or aspiring to democracy, as in Athens, were slave societies. The Southerners love to remind Americans of that fact.
That you could be both Cicero and slave owner, they fancied some.
Yes. And it's not well known that slavery persisted after the fall of the Roman Empire. In the Mediterranean region, and very large numbers of so-called Slavic slaves. The word slave actually comes from the Latin sclavus, meaning a Slav. So there's that ethnic connotation to our very word slave. But many thousands of Slavic slaves were transported from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean and sold both in Muslim and Christian markets, and I show there is significant continuity between that slave trade, which in many ways, except for it's not being really racial, though there was a kind of ethnic quality, but there's a continuity with the development of slave trading largely for sugar growing by the Portuguese in the Atlantic islands off the coast of Africa. And that's when America was discovered by Columbus in 1492. And incidentally, Columbus brought back some 400 Indian slaves. He thought there could be a good slave trade.
1495, just a handful of years later, and he's begun his own trade that way. Was it fated that slavery would become so huge in the Americas? Why did it? And why racialized around Africa?
Well, I think it was probably fated that slavery or coerced labor of some kind would become essential. There was just so much land, so many resources, and so little labor, most of Europeans were not at that point interested in crossing the Atlantic, let alone being engaged in that kind of labor.
But they were very interested in the fortunes to be made there.
Oh, indeed. And it is conceivable that, for example, Native Americans could have supplied the slave labor force if there had not been a pandemic in the 1500s, which wiped out up to 90% of the Native Americans because of diseases brought by the Europeans. Also, it's at least conceivable that the areas once under the Soviet Union in north of the Black Sea that had supplied so many slaves to the Mediterranean, that many slaves might have been brought to America theoretically from that region if the Muslims had not expanded and the Turks had captured Constantinople in 1453.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that after the Turks captured Constantinople in 1453, Europe, Christian Europe, was more and more dependent on slaves coming from sub-Saharan Africa.
But it wasn't just a geographic location, the source. It became very quickly quite deliberately racialized, and you describe that as central to the sort of staying power of African slavery in the Americas.
Oh, very, very much. And actually, it was really the Muslims who pioneered in racializing slavery, even though they continued to capture very large numbers of Europeans.
You describe an African uprising in Basra, now Iraq, centuries ago.
Yes, in the 9th century, there were many thousands of black slaves who rose in one of history's largest slave revolts that went on many years against the Arabs. And there were black slaves really from Muslim Spain all the way to India. And a very large slave trade by sea from East Africa to the Persian Gulf. So for many centuries, the Arabs and Persians were, in fact, using black slaves. And the stereotypes, the negative stereotypes of these black slaves were very similar to those that developed much later in Western Europe and the United States.
You describe contemporary Americans as living, many, in a kind of denial, the sort of mint julep haze, the gone with the wind haze. At the time, when slavery was, you know, in full flower in the American colonies, did they live in denial then, or was it completely accepted? And what was the justification, or did it need one?
Well, there was some important change in some of the colonies. For example, in 17th century Virginia, there were originally very large numbers of English indentured servants who were treated somewhat like slaves. And Virginia was dependent on this white labor. It did not start out really with any sense of dependency on black labor. It was only in the late 17th century that large numbers of African slaves began to be imported. But these African slaves worked often side by side with white indentured servants, and a full-blown racism did not develop in Virginia until the late 1600s and on into the 1700s. And to some degree, you get that a bit in Barbados, where also in the very early years, in the late 1620s and 30s, again, there were very large numbers of English indentured servants who were gradually replaced by black slaves. So there was interaction between, and indeed a good bit of sexual contact between white indentured servants and black slaves.
Mm. My own family is first American and indentured servant a little further north near Philadelphia, but that is another story. This is a gripping one. Jerry's calling from Conway, South Carolina. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well. What do you know, Jerry?
Well, through recent genealogical research, we've discovered that many members of our family owned slaves in this area. Our family goes back in this area into the 1700s, and I'll tell you that I certainly do not look at it through rose-colored glasses or view it as some sort of a mint julep syndrome. I think it's abhorrent. I just cannot conceive of somebody hardening their heart to the extent necessary to dominate and master another human being like that. And I'd like to ask the professor, given the destruction, almost complete destruction of the South after the Civil War, where I would assume that a great deal of the money and the fortunes generated by slavery must have either left and flown and been transported to the North, or it was originally there, because in the South there were very few families that had anything, including chairs and tables, let alone fortunes.
It's a great question, and David Brian Davis writes about it in some depth. Professor Davis, the wealth of that slave terrain, when it finally came crashing down, did it just walk away with the slaves? What about the gold?
Well, of course, you have with instant, almost immediate slave emancipation from 1863 to 1865, the vanishing of an absolutely immense amount of assets, of capital. Whereas most societies that emancipated slaves did offer some kind of compensation to the owners, because this was a civil war, of course, the owners received nothing. And in many, many parts of the South, slaves were quite determined to go on their own and to, if at all possible, start their own farms. But in many areas, they were actually not able to keep from having to work on plantations. So you have a slow resurgence, and the economy is very much better off by the 1880s and 90s. The South, in a way, it's been argued by some historians, and won the battle over Reconstruction, and was able to reassert white supremacy, if not slavery, and that was for a long time accepted in the North. That is the giving the South supremacy over blacks.
We'll talk about that, and of course we shouldn't ignore that a lot of that wealth in the South was recycled abundantly through the North. We'll look at that as well. But I wanted to ask you about something else that Jerry raised as he looked back on his own family and its slaveholding and how these people had hardened their hearts to the humanity of the slave, and not just in the South. You write about in New York City an uprising and widespread lynching and burning at the stake of African-American slaves. What was the kit bag that Americans used to harden their hearts to the humanity of these people?
Well, I think it's very difficult for us today even to imagine the contempt, the fear that most whites had in the pre-Civil War era as they viewed black slaves. I mean, racism was very, very deep, and there were race riots in the North, very, very destructive ones from Providence, Rhode Island, to Cincinnati, of course, in New York, in the famous or infamous draft riots of 1863, an untold number of blacks were killed. So the sort of thing we associate with Mississippi in 1873 and 1875, when Confederate veterans are actually committing acts of genocide in various areas in order to intimidate and scare all of the blacks, this sort of thing was by no means confined to the South.
Jennifer's calling from Southington, Connecticut. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I would just like to reiterate the point of that most Americans believe that slavery was just in the South, which is a huge misconception, and I think it's very damaging. I just wanted to say that I have been working with a team in Connecticut from Central Connecticut State University, and it's headed by Jerry Sawyer and Dr. Perry. And I just wanted to say that the North was just as complicit in the enslaving of African peoples, because their economy was just as dependent on these slaves, because the South, being the agricultural, produced all of these goods, or I'm sorry, raised, grew all of these goods, and the North profited by it by distributing it. And also, one other point I wanted to make is that Rhode Island was one of the largest slave ports, one of the largest slave importers. And I'm sorry, a third point. The abolitionists, I know that a lot of children in American schools have grown up with the idea that the Northerners were the abolitionists and that they were all abolitionists. And I just wanted to say that there was very few, and there was only a handful, and they were quite ostracized.
We'll come to that willed moral achievement, as David Brian Davis describes it. And Jennifer, thank you for your call. Professor Davis, you're very clear on the wealth generated in the North by the three-way trade, by the multinational trade that developed off of slavery. And you say this was not, by no means faceless. The wealthy of the North socialized, intermarried directly and personally were connected to the wealth of families in the South.
Oh, that's right. And I wanted just to say those points the caller made are extremely important. Few people realize that slavery was legal in Connecticut until 1848, and legal in New York State until 1827, and in New Jersey, really legal until the Civil War. So we just don't usually think of the North as having slaves. But in, say, 1750, black slaves did at least half of all the labor, heavy labor, in New York City.
Jack, it's a much more complex picture that emerges here, and the depth of it almost bottomless.
Yes, and the range of inhumanity, the dehumanization that sets in. You know, I heard a story recently about it was told by someone who had been a refugee after in a concentration camp after Kristallnacht in Germany, and the person was there looking out the barbed wire, and a German woman and her mother and her daughter were walking by, and the daughter asked the mother, "Who are those people?" And the mother said, "Those aren't people, those are Jews." That dehumanization, which seems to be so essential to systems of mass extermination and systems that border on that, like slavery, that just happens again and again and again in history.
I want to look at abolition. I also want to look, Professor Davis, at the non-economic aspect. Jack mentioned it earlier. You remind us, Aristotle wrote that the ox was the poor man's slave. Initial enslavement sort of modeled on the bestialization of prisoners, of the taming of wild animals. You remind us of the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass describing the slave breaker, Mr. Covey, who had tamed him, and quoting Frederick Douglass when he says, "I was broken in body, soul, and spirit. My natural elasticity was crushed. My intellect languished. The disposition to read departed. The cheerful spark that lingered about my eye died. The dark night of slavery closed in upon me, and behold, a man transformed into a brute." And you make this point, David Brian Davis, that in some dimension, early Americans' sense of their own freedom in this new free land was defined in contrast to the bondage of slaves. I wish you'd elaborate on that.
Well, one sees this particularly in Virginia, which, of course, was the heartland of the emergence of the ideals that came in with the American Revolution. It was from Virginia that we have Washington, Madison, and Jefferson and all the rest. And one finds that in the late 1600s and early 1700s, Virginia leaders were more and more addressing the lower classes and assuring them that they were dignified and free and part of the society because they were white. And leaders were able to play on that contrast between black and white so that the lower classes or the ordinary small farmers could take pride in not being black and being in some way superior.
They might not be rich, they might not be a big landowner, but at least they were not slaves. They were, white once it had been racialized.
And indeed, later on, John C. Calhoun, when he was Secretary of War around 1820, shocked John Quincy Adams, who was Secretary of State, by telling Adams that in the South there was no class conflict, that the whites felt allied and at one with the leaders and with people like Calhoun because they differentiated themselves from the blacks.
Mary's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. To me, slavery is maintained through language because you can dehumanize through language. And the proof in point is your last show when you tried to explain how, you know, why kill the kids. And the female guest couldn't understand. And as long as her point was gotten across that these Islamists, these Iraqis, these Iranians, they weren't human. So you can do anything once you determine that a group of people is not human.
And language, as the barge that all floats on. David Brown Davis, how about language in the dehumanization? When we've heard about the physical and the great brutality of the physical, what about the language, the conceptual?
Well, I think that's a very important issue, certainly. And the term Negro and the unpronounceable mm-hmm. variation on it mm-hmm. were used as great symbols of contempt. I think contempt is one of the elements there. I actually think a good bit more study is needed of language and the role of language in separating the races and making whites feel superior.
You write that slavery in some aspects was more brutal in the New World than it had been, at least for a very long time, elsewhere. What portion of that is economically driven? What portion because of the new racial categorizations that were emphasized here?
Well, I think both are relevant. Certainly, slavery became more intense when it was yoked to a capitalist system of production, so that particularly in the Caribbean, where there was very little paternalism in the British West Indies, and there mm-hmm. was an effort to get the absolute maximum production of sugar. But then there is also that racial factor, which divides masters and slaves even more than in the Old World, where, let's say, in Roman times, you had virtually every ethnic group from north to south enslaved or represented by slaves.
And so it could be someone who looked just like the master. A different story. I mean, you remind us there of the uprising under Spartacus and the miles and miles of crucified slaves. So it was hardly new, but it was fierce. Sheila's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Sheila, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you know?
Well, I'm a long ago student of Professor Davis.
Oh, great.
And graduate student of his. And I'm well out of academia now, but I'm so excited to hear about this book. Every time he publishes one, people says it's the, you know, the crowning moment in his career, and he just keeps going on.
A lot of
on.
Crowns stacked up there.
Yes, indeed. But I'm interested in having Professor Davis speak a bit to the fact that of America's peculiar institution, what set slavery in this country apart from slavery in other countries, and I'm thinking in particular about Virginia and the early part of the 18th century, where the notion of slavery begins to change and this whole ideology and racialization grows up.
Professor Davis, well, the distinction.
It's good to hear your voice again.
you remember.
I think the perhaps the main point is that no other slave society had really adopted the ideals of equality and upward mobility, the sense that you could really change your status by hard work and all. And that,
in other words, the free community had that ideology around
yes.
the slave core there, yes?
Right. So that the combination of slavery and the ideals that culminated in the American Revolution is a very peculiar mix. And, of course, it it did lead ultimately to abolition movements. Many Americans, even many slaveholders, were very conscious of the supreme contradiction of holding slaves, dehumanizing slaves on the one hand, and yet being committed to liberty, equality, and the pursuit of happiness.
But it didn't make the slavery, the enslavement, any milder.
No, it certainly did not. There were, one needs to note, a surprising number of manumissions during, for various causes,
that
during
is
the American Revolution.
Of slaves, yes.
During and then after the American Revolution, Virginia actually made it much easier to manumit slaves for a period. This was reversed, I think, in 1806, but there was a time when the free black and colored population increased very, very rapidly in the Upper South. And certainly that was partly affected by the ideals of the American Revolution.
Our time grows short, that we could go on for a century here, and I wish we could do it longer, but I want to look at the abolition piece of this. You call it, you point to the positive message in a willed moral achievement. And you begin by looking at British abolitionism, which precedes American, of course, and I wish you'd remind us of that. But you call it exceptional because, and this is kind of an important message in these times, because it raises profound and universal questions about the nature and possibility of collective moral actions in human history. In other words, it's evidence that there can be a kind of moral progress. Remind us of the significance of the British action, then how it rolled forward through the American story, which in the space of a little more than a century changed something that was absolutely taken for granted into something that was completely outlawed.
Yes, well, I'm struck above all on a kind of abstract level by the fact that slavery was legal throughout the New World in the 1770s, and when the first feeble, small abolition societies were formed in Britain and in America in the 1780s, it would have appeared that they couldn't do very much at all. And yet by 1888, when Brazil finally outlawed slavery, slavery had been abolished throughout the entire hemisphere. And that was largely because of the actions of abolition movements. For a time, historians argued that it was for economic reasons, that Britain, it was for Britain's own self-interest, economic self-interest, to end the slave trade and to emancipate slaves. But we now know that that's been pretty much repudiated, thoroughly repudiated, so that there is no question the abolitionist movements were enormously successful in Britain, especially in mobilizing hundreds of thousands, eventually even over a million, who would sign petitions and interrogate candidates and all, so that this actually was a remarkable, what I call a shift or change, a revolutionary change in moral perception, so that the peoples of Britain and a good many in the North came to see slavery as an evil that had to be gotten rid of.
Britain did that. America did not. You write, it's fascinating, about what you call the perishability of revolutionary time, a kind of moment in the 1780s, an upsurge in anti-slavery fervor in the Upper South as well as in the North. But then the American government, heavily dominated by Southern slaveholding interests for decades, describe the chemistry that broke it open again. It was more than just one Abe Lincoln stepping forward.
Indeed. I would mention just very quickly that in the Revolutionary era, there were some significant steps taken, such as the Northwest Ordinance that banned slavery in the entire territories north of the Ohio River, that is Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana, and so on. Even Jefferson earlier had proposed a banning of slavery in all of the West. To turn to the main question you ask, mm-hmm. It was in the 1850s that much more politically oriented anti-slavery movement arises. The North became particularly aroused by the Fugitive Slave Act and the vision of having all kinds of Southern agents pursuing blacks, even Northern blacks, and criminally enslaving them.
And we're reminded in that whites were required to join the kind of round-em-up gangs. They could
absolutely
be almost pressed into service to bring any black. And it makes us think of the immigration debate going on right now in a way that would felonize aid to immigrants. But I didn't mean to interrupt your flow there. And from that, soon we're in the Civil War.
That's certainly correct. And I argue in a way that the South became so frightened by the British abolition movement and its success, and so alarmed by the prospect of abolitionists stirring up slave revolts, that they tended to overreact to a very weak anti-slavery movement in the North in the 1830s and 40s with such measures as the gag rule in Congress, and that the Southern really a counterproductive overreactions helped to unify more Northerners against the South. Even if they might hate blacks, they still became anti-Southern.
Jack, ultimately here, as David Brian Davis describes it, a vast example of a willed moral achievement, and heartening in that, given all the woe that came before.
Yes, he quotes a book about the British abolition called Econocide, that the British actually killed off a portion of their economy for the sake of, really, ideals. And that, of course, is, as he says, is a continual inspiration, that the world we are born in, we do not have to accept, and that the wrong that just seems to be the way things are doesn't have to be accepted. And, you know, probably you'd said to anybody, at any point of this, could slavery be abolished? They would say things like, well, what would you do with the slaves afterwards? Which was a big question. Mm. They would say things like, well, what about the safety of my wife and kids sleeping at night? The slaves, if they're free, they'll just go in there. They would talk about the money. There would be all these practical, political, economic objections, and still it was changed, of course, by force. But what made the force inevitable was the change in moral perception.
David Brian Davis, if Americans could take this full text on board, just implant it, what is the message in this all this for us today? What's most important for us to understand out of all this historical understanding as we live as Americans in this world now?
Well, I think we need to recognize and understand what I call this darker side of our past. There is a very ugly and shocking part of our history that we tend to ignore, especially in mindless celebrations of the past. On the other hand, the success of the abolition movement, this willed achievement, I think is extremely encouraging in the sense that it does show that we don't have to accept the world into which we're born, that things can change for the better, and that indeed, it's a bit ironic that when the British anti-slavery parliamentary people wanted to abolish the slave trade, they disguised their moral reasons and put forth, this was especially to abolish the British slave trade to foreign areas, they argued it on political and economic terms that it was in Britain's interest, and they felt they had to repress their very fervent moral and religious views.
But you show us the moral ember at the heart of it, and very much more. David Brian Davis, author of Inhuman Bondage, thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Well, it's been a great privilege, I can assure you, for me.
David Brian Davis, Inhuman Bondage, The Rise and Fall of Slavery in the New World. Jack Beattie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.